Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Say I'm a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
It's May 2nd, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Todd Stiefel. Humanism is the life stance of being good without God.
We are just starting to recover from our big weekend in Boston, Massachusetts. Did you have fun at the AHA 70th Annual Conference?
I did indeed. It was a blast, actually. It was a whirlwind couple of days, but really fun, really interesting. Learned a lot, met some great people.
Nice. What were some of your highlights of the weekend?
Highlights of the weekend. I would say recording some of the interviews for this show was an absolute blast. And I got to spend a fair bit of time with Greg Epstein and some of the folks from the Harvard Humanist Chaplaincy Sunday night. And that was really interesting. And also went on the tour of Salem, and we burned some witches, and no, we didn't really, but we learned about the killing of witches, and which was frankly somewhat depressing, but it was still very interesting. And Salem itself is a pretty little port town now, not like the port's all that functional anymore, but it was a cute town, so it was a good time. It was great.
Those were some of my highlights as well. Certainly meeting, you know, Richard Dawkins and Candace Gingrich, listening to Judy Norsegian and Steve Wozniak. He signed my Mac laptop.
Nice.
Yep. So we thought we'd start this month off with our Friday night's event, which was the Humanist of the Year Award. And we're also going to play a little teaser of an interview for you at the end. We also have two listener comments to play for you folks, so stay tuned for that. But before we get into all that sort of conference material, Todd, what's been happening in the world?
For one thing, the National Day of Reason is coming up later this week on the 5th of May. It's always the first Thursday of the year, coinciding with the National Day of Prayer. And I personally prefer the Day of Reason. And so I think a lot of groups around the country, a lot of humanists have been active preparing for the day and preparing different festivities.
So Todd, how would people know where to find these events? How do you know if there's something happening in your area? Or what do you do if you want to host an event yourself?
Thanks for asking, Jess. I think that's a great question. Well, listeners, you can go to nationaldayofreason.org. And you can see there what the event is all about and a list of activities all around the country that are planned and, you know, what this is going to do and what we're hoping to accomplish. So
absolutely. NationalDayOfReason.org. You can search for an event in your area. You can add your name to our list of endorsers. You can learn how to encourage your local government to officially recognize the National Day of Reason. And you can also share the National Day of Reason throughout Facebook and Twitter.
Absolutely. I'm particularly excited about the local event taking place here in the Triangle area of North Carolina. I'm obviously the most familiar with that because it's local, but this one's going to be particularly interesting. Last year on the Day of Prayer in North Carolina, they had an event on the state capitol grounds after the governor issued a proclamation encouraging everyone to pray and used specific Christian language about how they should pray and what kind of prayers they should do. And their event had a podium with the state seal on it, and a Supreme Court justice from the North Carolina Supreme Court spoke. And it's interesting because I'm not opposed personally to a National Day of Prayer so long as it's privately organized. Hey, more power to you. Go for it. It's a free country. My problem is when the government starts endorsing it and when the government starts telling people when and where and how they should pray. That I have a big problem with. Well, what we did is went and tried to protest the event, and we're successful, but we're relegated to behind the Capitol and across the street with our permit. And we weren't a big fan of that. So we thought ahead a bit and actually got the permit for their spot on the Capitol grounds for this year. So
nice.
This year we have the Capitol grounds and we're going to have a big, awesome celebration and they can be across the street protesting us.
That's great. I love it.
So Roy Speckhart, the executive director of the AHA, is coming to town, and Maggie Ardiente, the development director, is also coming down with him, and Roy's going to be speaking. And we also have Sean Faircloth from the Secular Coalition for America speaking. I'm going to be giving a little speech. And then there's going to be a whole day of activities. We're going to the Science Museum, going for lunch. And there's going to be additional speakers in the evening. It's going to be really, really cool, fun event.
That's great, Todd. I like to see this shift, because I remember last year or in previous years, a lot of National Day of Reason events have been in protest of National Day of Prayer events. But I think that a lot of other groups are following the trend of, hey, let's celebrate reason ourselves and let the religious folks protest that for us. I think that's kind of neat.
It's awesome. So, Jess, you were talking about a certain brave girl that was in attendance at the AHA conference. You want to share some of that with our listeners?
Sure. So there's a high school student named Jessica Alquist. She's a sophomore at Cranston High School West in Rhode Island, and she has recently filed a lawsuit, a federal lawsuit, against her school for displaying a religious prayer in the form of a banner in her in the school's auditorium. So I guess this banner has been hanging in her school for just about 50 years, and it was actually adopted as the official prayer of the school around 1960. And let me just read the beginning of it to you. It begins by asking our Heavenly Father to grant students the desire to do their best to help them grow, be kind, be good sports, and the like. The lawsuit alleges that hanging this prayer violates Jessica's First and 14th Amendments, and based on Supreme Court precedent, it does.
Absolutely. The banner itself actually has on it in print school prayer.
Right.
Which has been, school prayer has been outlawed by the Supreme Court, at least the recitation of it. So assumably having an official school prayer would also be illegal. It does end in amen. So yeah, what a brave girl. Good for her, Jessica, if you're listening out there. Kudos to you for having the courage to stand up to the establishment. I'm sure this has had its social repercussions, which is unfortunate, but there's always hate mongers out there. And you know, I give you all the props in the world for having the courage to stand up and do what's right and stand against discrimination. So congratulations.
For sure. And listeners, I'd like to encourage you to reach out to Jessica Alquist, because and her family and her friends, her supporters, because you can imagine doing something like this. It creates a buzz in your community, and I'm sure she's receiving support, and I'm sure she's also receiving some backlash from others in her community. So just knowing that she's not alone, and that, you know, we're proud of her, and I'm sure that would be helpful.
Absolutely.
And actually, listeners, one way that you can support Jessica is by calling our listener comment line and leaving us a message so that we can play it on the show. So to do that, just call 202-618-1371, and we'll be happy to play your message. And speaking of listener comments, Todd, we actually have two to play for our listeners this month.
That's right, Jess. We talked about this last month, where Brigham Young University has an honor code that specifically forbids any kind of premarital sex. And one of their star basketball players broke the honor code and was very publicly suspended from the team and humiliated at a national level about this. And then the question becomes, A, is the honor code just and moral to forbid such natural activity? B, whether or not it's right or wrong, does this person have the responsibility to live up to an agreement they have signed? And then, did the school take the right action in this? Did they create more harm or good by enforcing this code in such a public way? So it'll be interesting to hear what the listeners have to say about this.
Indeed. So let's roll those clips now.
This is about the honor code at Brigham Young University and the student who broke it. First of all, I think it's very important to know that he did sign an honor code agreement, that he would follow it. But at the same time, it's also fair to say that the honor code itself is ridiculous. I mean, abstaining from coffee, abstaining from tea, and how are they going to enforce that? Honestly, if it's a honor policy, like a personal honor policy, they're going to have a really hard time doing that. I think that they should reevaluate the honor code, and I think he should be reinstated because their team is going to suffer, and it's a ridiculous rule. Thanks.
I agree. This is a Scurf commenting on your number 60, the shining light of reason for the basketball player that got called violating the honor code. Now, I understand that when I begin speaking, that I accept that a person can lead a moral life that generates a productive lifestyle for both himself and the community. And I state this as a person that is the follower of no defined spiritual path and a member of any organized spiritual community. Now, for Brandon Davis, well, quite frankly, he signed a contract. Nobody twisted his arm. He opted to go to school. He willingly accepted the terms of the contract. So all of the regards for that is on him. Was it the best option for him? I don't know. I'm not in a situation. I can't quite comment on that entirely. I will say this. I have signed contracts before. I have lived up to my obligations, as is every veteran of the United States military. Looking at this, I'm going to look at this both as potential harm to himself and harm to the community. One, in doing this, when he had sex with his girlfriend, he knew he was taking a risk. In the community, by the community standards, premarital sex is considered taboo for whatever reason, okay? That's on them. But by doing that, he not only damaged his own career possibilities and potentially produced a child, he also damaged the reputation of the school. I have to ask, on what grounds do you cite that as immoral? And that's a question that's chewing on me a little bit. Is it simply due to the religious-centric origins of their deal? Is it due to a natural law and right to do as one wishes? I mean, I'd like a little clarification there, if possible.
Well, it's an interesting debate. I look forward to sharing more of those kind of stories with our listeners over time and getting their reactions to them. So, Jess, I was inspired recently by a line in a song I've heard for many, many years. And I guess I had noticed the line in the past, but I had never really thought about it in much detail. And it struck me here. So I've got a quick trivia question for you in the world of music. I'm going to give you a quote from a song, and I'd like you to name the artist and the song title. You think you can do it?
I'll do my best. I mean, hell yeah.
No hell yeah. Far away across the fields, tolling on the iron bell, calls the faithful to their knees to hear the softly spoken magic spell.
I'm assuming it's some sort of classic rock genre.
It is. Getting warmer.
Mm-hmm.
You have a guess?
Well, it almost sounds, I don't think that Pink Floyd's classic rock, is it?
It is Pink Floyd.
Let's see, I know there's a Pink Floyd song that, who covered it recently?
Did Johnny Cash cover it? He's done a lot of covers. He did a lot of covers during the end of his career.
Maybe.
Would you like me to tell you the song?
I'm thinking of...
You're not ready to give in. That's good. I'm not ready to give in.
No.
You're resilient.
I can hear it. The chorus.
Far away across the field, tolling on the iron bell, calls the faithful to their knees, hear the softly spoken magic spell.
What's the name?
Time.
All right, I would not have guessed that.
Off of Dark Side of the Moon. I found the lyric to be pretty interesting. Far away across the field, tolling on the iron bell, calls the faithful to their knees to hear the softly spoken magic spell. So is prayer just a magic spell?
Kind of like a subliminal message?
Yeah, I mean, I hadn't thought about it this way. I mean, I've heard this song for years, even back before I was an atheist. I was a believer, and it kind of just passed through my mind as I heard it, but I think it's a fair point. Prayer is just, I think it might just be a magic spell. I mean, they're people, when they pray, are reciting something and they're hoping it creates magic. They're hoping it, the result of this will violate the rules of the natural world and give them something they want. It's essentially a magic spell, but it doesn't work.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, that's asking something that doesn't exist to do something that is impossible.
Yeah.
You would think that can only be done through magic. Interesting, Todd. And I have a trivia question for you.
Okay. I like trivia.
All right. So my question for you is, what do these people have in common? Alice Walker, Richard Dawkins, Ted Turner, Margaret Atwood, Carl Sagan, and Rebecca Goldstein.
The spelling of their names all include vowels?
Well, yes.
And they're all winners of the Humanist of the Year Award from the American Humanist Association. Am I correct?
You are correct, Todd.
Excellent.
Well, Todd, that's a great segue into our next segment, which is Rebecca Goldstein accepting our Humanist of the Year Award from our conference last month. And introducing her is none other than her husband, Steven Pinker. So, listeners, I'm sure many of you are familiar with Steven Pinker, but for those of you who aren't, Steven Pinker is a Harvard College professor and also a Johnstone Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard. Also a previous winner of the Humanist of the Year Award. Pinker has taught in the Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences at MIT. He conducts research on language and cognition, writes for publications such as the New York Times, Time, The New Republic, and he's an author of 7 books. Among them are The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, Words and Rules, The Blank Slate, and most recently, The Stuff of Thought, Language as a Window into Human Nature. So Stephen had the pleasure of introducing his wife, our recipient of the Humanist of the Year, Rebecca Goldstein.
I was a fan of Rebecca Goldstein long before we met, at least 15 years before we met, when shortly after the publication of her first novel, The Mind-Body Problem, it was already an underground classic, and anyone in academia knew that this was the book that you had to read. It was quite a sensation, because it was a novel set in academia that violated all of the conventions of the academic novel. It was not about a middle-aged male English professor who was disillusioned by his work. It was about a brainy, sexy, young female graduate student who traveled in the world not of English literature, but of philosophy, of mathematics, of science, of secular moral philosophy, and who, together with other characters in the novel, far from being disillusioned by ideas, were absolutely energized by them. The title of the novel, The Mind-Body Problem, is, of course, a double entendre. The protagonist of the novel is doing her thesis in philosophy on the classic mind-body problem, but she also faces her own mind-body problem, namely, which of the two ought one to concentrate on in setting one's priorities in life, in particular in choosing a man. This duality of that ideas that have been discussed in philosophy and that energize people interested in ideas can also be an obsession as people live their lives is a theme that runs through all of Rebecca's novels. They have been called novels of ideas, but in a way that sells them short, because often, when a novelist tries to introduce ideas into a novel or a work of fiction or a work of drama, the results are not always pretty. You sometimes get a character who is basically a robot whose mouth opens and a speech comes pouring out. The novels of Ayn Rand might be an example of that. One sometimes gets a portrait of intellectuals and people engaged with ideas of the kind one sees in Woody Allen films, where intellectual life consists of of brandishing names in cocktail party conversation, talking about Sartre and McLuhan and Schopenhauer, I think of as Schope talk, without any engagement with the actual ideas. I think that Rebecca has revolutionized the so-called novel of ideas by opening up a whole set of dramatic possibilities that had not been explored sufficiently in art before, namely that the ideas that engage philosophers and physicists and mathematicians, and for that matter, anyone who is energized by ideas, are exactly the ideas that everyone has to grapple with in navigating their own lives. The ideas that matter to people, ideas about truth and morality and personal identity and knowledge and certainty. These are the ideas that the characters in Rebecca's novels talk about and grapple with, but they are also the ideas that they are obsessed with in the conduct of their own lives, and that all of us must be obsessed with in the conduct of our lives. This parallelism between the ideas and the priorities in life energizes each of Rebecca's works of fiction, in each one in a radically different way. After The Mind-Body Problem, Rebecca has published another in all seven works of fiction, The Late Summer Passion of a Woman of Mind, The Dark Sister, one of my favorites because it brings to life one of our joint heroes, the psychologist and philosopher William James, Mazel, Strange Attractors, a book of stories, and her most recent 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction, which, by the way, is a part of the title. Now, knowing Rebecca's biography, one would not have guessed that this would be the path that she would take in life. She grew up the daughter of a cantor in an ultra-Orthodox family in White Plains, New York, and then committed the ultimate act of rebellion. She studied philosophy. She got a bachelor's degree in philosophy at Barnard College and then a PhD in philosophy at Princeton University, working with Thomas Nagel of What Is It Like to Be a Bat fame. Her own thesis was on reduction realism in the mind and was a philosophical investigation of the problem of consciousness within a scientific framework, at a time well before consciousness was a respectable topic in philosophy and in science. She then was a professor of philosophy at Barnard College and Rutgers and Trinity College, has also been a professor of writing at Columbia. In 2005, she published another work in another genre, a biography of the mathematician Kurt Gödel called Incompleteness, The Proof and Paradox of Kurt Gödel, which analyzed his famous proof and his own convictions in a philosophical context, followed by Betraying Spinoza, which David mentioned, and 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. A novel that it would be an understatement to say that I recommend it to all of you. I consider it to be the great humanist novel. The 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, which incidentally are reproduced together with their refutations as an appendix to the novel, because they also constitute the appendix to an atheist bestseller by the protagonist of the novel, who achieves surprising fame because he has been elevated as a humanist of the year following the publication of his book, which was not actually a book about atheism. The appendix was an afterthought. It was a book about the psychological motivations that make religion so compelling to people, and which, typical of the subtle and complex layering of ideas and characters and dialogue and plot and themes in Rebecca's novels, is also what the novel is about. I think one of the great mysteries to all of us is that, given that the arguments for the existence of God, 36 or more, are so uncompelling, they are deftly and swiftly refuted in the appendix to the book, as they are by, of course, the protagonist of the book. Why is religion such a consequential phenomenon in life, even today in an age in which one might think that the arguments have been so refuted that religion would not commend itself to anyone. Well, we have an inkling of the answer that religion is not just about God. It is about people's obsessions with paradoxes of personal identity and morality and immortality and messianism and community and the mystery of divine genius, all of which are played out by the characters in the novel as they grapple with them simultaneously as intellectual problems. Rebecca's works have been recognized in numerous prizes, including, when she was an undergraduate, the Montague Prize in Philosophy, the National Jewish Book Award, the Whiting Award. She is an elected fellow of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, the recipient of two honorary doctorates, the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award, and just 2 weeks ago delivered the Tanner Lectures on Human Values at Yale University. But I am sure that among the sweetest of these awards is the one that she is receiving tonight, and I'm happy to and proud to introduce to you the 2011 Humanist of the Year, Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein.
Thank you so much. That was, it was certainly the best introduction I've ever received. And Steve is so right that this is the sweetest award that I've ever gotten. Given the sort of family that I grew up in, Steve had mentioned that it was an ultra-Orthodox Jewish family, and that doesn't even, I think, begin to do it justice. In fact, when Steve first met me and met my family, he said, even though he himself is Jewish, I just didn't know that there were Jews like this left in the Western world. Given the sort of family in which I grew up, in which the whole idea of a girl with large intellectual ambitions was beyond the pale, the only kind of ambition a girl like me was permitted to dream of was to get married as early as possible and to have as many children as one's body could bear. Nice double entendre there. Given that sort of family and my own set of peculiar ambitions, I had to find my own guidance. And this depended primarily on reading, but it also depended a great deal on my finding for myself heroes, intellectual heroes, people not only whose ideas, specific ideas, inspired me and whose arguments I found clear and beautiful and elegant, but whose lives and the role that ideas played in their lives was an inspiration to me and showed me a new model for how I might be able to live my life. It opened up new possibilities for me. Unfortunately, most of the models that I found, most of my intellectual heroes, were dead white males. Certainly Baruch Spinoza, David Hume, Charles Darwin, William James, Albert Einstein, Bertrand Russell. But very fortunately for me, one of those intellectual heroes of mine is, although he's a white male, is very much alive. And it's the man who introduced me. We're very lucky, those of us who live or are associated with Harvard, Harvard has a secular humanist chaplain. He's right here, Greg Epstein. He's done an extraordinary job. I was dubious. I was skeptical of this position. I've even been known to make fun of it a little bit. But Greg has proved me wrong. He has created such a vibrant, intellectual and ethical and spiritual community of secular humanists at Harvard. And every year he gives an award to somebody. And this year it was the actor Stephen Fry. I didn't actually know who Stephen Fry was by name. But when I met him, I said, oh, my God, you're Oscar Wilde. If any of you have not seen Stephen Fry in that movie, Wilde, it's extraordinary. He liked that very much. And then in his wonderful, wonderful acceptance speech to, I think, about 1,100 people at the Memorial Chapel at Harvard, he quoted and impersonated Wilde a great deal, so much so that I immediately went back and started to reread some Oscar Wilde. And I hadn't read De Profundis in quite some time. De Profundis, of course, is that heartbreaking, tragic letter that Wilde writes to Lord Alfred. What's his first name? Bosie. Bosie was his nickname. That Wilde writes to Bosie while he is in jail. His body and his spirit being broken down by hard labor and just by the terrible injustice that he is suffering in jail. And I came upon the following passage. When I think about religion at all, I feel as if I would like to found an order for those who cannot believe. The confraternity of the fatherless, one might call it, where on an altar on which no taper burns, a priest in whose heart peace has no dwelling, might celebrate with unblessed bread and a chalice empty of wine. And as I look around here, I feel like we are the realization of poor Oscar Wilde's wistful fantasy, this order of those who can't believe, the confraternity of the fatherless. An order of those that cannot believe. There's an ambiguity to this term. Is this inability to believe an incapacity, or is it an endowment? Is it a sign of failure, or is it a sign of strength? When you were brought up in the way that I was brought up, and I think as many of you were brought up, although the religions may have been different, in a very, very religious household, you're made to feel as if not being able to believe all the things that those around you believe is a lack in you. It's a moral failing. And you feel this very strongly, and you try to work to become like those whom you love, your family, your community. You try to believe in things for which there is no evidence at all, and you try, or even there's evidence to the contrary, and you try very, very hard to believe in shaky, pitifully shaky arguments, and there's just something wrong with you. That you can't do it, and the people around you are always encouraging you and trying to and praying for you and trying to get you to be able to believe on no grounds at all, and that this is a kind of moral failure on your part. There is a moralization to epistemology. Epistemology, of course, And philosophy is the branch that studies knowledge itself. What is it? What is the difference between knowledge and mere belief? What kinds of grounds do you have in order to really know something as opposed to merely believe it? Even if it's true, if you just happen to believe it for bad reasons, this doesn't count as knowledge. And there's a kind of morality to epistemology that gets very twisted around sometimes in the context of religion, where the very groundlessness of a belief that leaves you, therefore, free to believe on faith, that's the triumph. It's a strange perversion of the epistemology of belief, the morality and ethics of belief. And it was, for me, I think, you know, the doubts started very, very early, and it was this a very long time. In fact, I guess until I read Bertrand Russell's Why I Am Not a Christian. I was never a Christian. I was simply a Jew. But those, and the analysis of his arguments, the arguments for God's existence and what goes wrong with them, was suddenly everything got switched around for me, and I saw that it's not a triumph to believe on the basis of bad grounds. Bad grounds are bad grounds. And there's nothing heroic about believing when you're, when you don't have good reasons to believe. Quite the contrary. The heroism lies in, demanding standards for belief, in demanding good grounds for belief. That there's a kind of heroism in heresy. And so this notion of those who cannot believe, that an order of those who cannot believe, I think that Wilde's words there are telling us that this is not an inability, this is an achievement, this not being able to believe. So too with his words, a confraternity of the fatherless. The wonderful thing is that there is a kind of confraternity. If you actually do struggle away from beliefs that you inherit just because of the particular group into which you happen to have been born, and you actually struggle to ground these beliefs, there is a sweetness of unanimity that is a consequence of this. Because all people who are trying to move away from the beliefs into which they were born and trying to actually struggle toward objectivity, toward rationality, toward reason, are going to be going in the same direction. And it is so extraordinarily moving to me, having grown up in such an insular community in which when we spoke about we, that was defined purely in terms of the group into which we were born. There is such a sweetness to me in meeting people who come from traditions and from groups that are so dissimilar from mine, and the agreement, the unity of mind, the complete understanding we have of one another because we've embraced objectivity, we've embraced reason. And this, of course, was the great dream of another great hero of mine, Baruch Spinoza. Baruch Spinoza, who predates the Enlightenment by about 100 years, but whose ideas seeded the Enlightenment, the European Enlightenment. He was the kind of radicalized Europe, and it took a long time for Europe to finally catch up with this heretic, this excommunicated Jew. And we're still catching up, I believe, to Spinoza. It was Spinoza's dream that as we detached from the irrational views into which we're born, that we inherit, that we embrace simply out of loyalty to our groups, that we detach from points of view that simply try to self-aggrandize our own position in the world and that try to offer us false consolation that we're lucky enough to be in the right group, that we're somehow going to be protected from all of the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune because of the luck of the group into which we were born or the group that we have adopted. That Baruch Spinoza's great hope was as we detached from that and we struggled toward objectivity, we would all be reaching the same sorts of beliefs and that we would be able to understand one another and share one another and the contingencies of our birth, the particular people we happen to be born into, would shrivel away into nothingness. And he had so radical a view of this that he believed that to the extent that we're rational, we all share in exactly the same identity. He was a secularist and a radical secularist before the word secularism even existed. He's often referred to as a Jewish secularist, and I think that this is not true. He was a secularist. He didn't think that his particular identity as a Jew was important. He didn't think that any of these identities that we inherit are important. The only thing that is important are the ideas that we struggle towards, that we struggle to ground. And to the extent that we do, we share one another's minds. We understand one another, and there's understanding between us and hopefully tranquility among us as well. I mean, this was his extraordinary hope. It was so premature at the time that he hoped it. He had got nothing but trouble. He was excommunicated at the age of 24. We still don't know exactly why, but every curse in the good book was thrown at him. Curse be he when he gets up, and curse be he when he lies down, and curse be he when he goes out, and curse be he when he comes in, and curse be he by day, and curse be he by night. And it went on and on. He was smart enough not to show up for his own excommunication. But we're not even quite sure why he was so excommunicated, why he was. Excommunication was a form of societal control that was, that particular community, a very, very troubled community, consisting as it did of refugees from the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisition. So these were returnees to Judaism because they had all been forced to convert to Catholicism at the end of the 15th century. So these were, his community consist of returnees, and they were very traumatized people, and they often used this form of excommunication, but it was a temporary thing. One was excommunicated, one sometimes for a day, sometimes for a few weeks. If it was really serious infraction, for a year or two, but one did one's penance, and one was welcomed back into the community. In fact, one of Spinoza's contemporaries was excommunicated twice, but they welcomed him back. And Spinoza is the only one on record who was excommunicated with no chance of reconciliation. Get lost. We don't want to ever see you again. No chance of ever doing penance and coming back. And as far as we know, he never looked back. The words reported when they when they brought news of the excommunication was that he said, "I wouldn't have had the courage to do this on my own, but since they throw me out, I go happily." So his Jewish identity, I think, was not so very, very important to him. That any of these inherited forms was not important to him. He looked forward, he dreamed of the day when these sorts of differences will matter to us not at all, and that all of us who embrace reason will identify with one another in the only way that matters, and we'll understand one another, and we'll have similar minds. I first learned about Spinoza when I was, I think, 14. I was going to a very religious all-girls school, the kind of school where, you know, we had to wear skirts down to our ankles and sleeves down to our wrists. We were not encouraged to go on to college. Probably the very, very worst thing that you could possibly study was philosophy, which the word was that it teaches you to question everything. And so I think actually even before I had graduated from that school, I had used one of my summer vacations to take a summer course at Columbia in philosophy. And we heard about Spinoza in this class we had of Jewish history. I actually, by that time, was mostly playing hooky. I hated that school. And we were studying modernity. And we were against modernity. we were there. There was no ambiguity here. Everything went wrong. Everything went wrong after Babylonia, basically. And as a kind of cautionary tale, the teacher mentioned this boy who was born, as we all had been in that school, into a good Jewish family. His family had suffered trauma because of being Jewish, and so had my family. And my father came from Poland. And in fact, most of the kids in my class were children of survivors of the Holocaust. And the teacher told the story of this bad boy, Baruch Spinoza, born Baruch Spinoza, but after his excommunication, changed his name to Benedictus. Baruch means blessed in Hebrew, and of course Benedictus means blessed in Latin. And she said, I remember that he was, he said the most outrageous things. And after the Jews had put him into cherem, which is the word for Jewish excommunication, the Christians all damned him, that he was vilified throughout Europe, which is true. The woman spoke the truth there. And that, you know, what a disgrace it was for the Jews that this you know, even Christians saw, he brought shame on the Jewish people. And he said such stupid things. He said that nature is God. And he said that the Torah, the five books of Moses, weren't written by Moses. That they had many authors, and I was thinking, I was listening to Bart Ehrman. Of course, the first biblical scholar, the first biblical critic, was Spinoza. He really founded modern biblical criticism. He was the one who first looked, and he particularly was studying the five books of Moses. Looked at the internal contradictions and at the different authors, and he saw that claimed that there were at least four different authors, and he thinks whoever compiled it lived in the Second Temple period. He thinks it was probably Ezra who did the compilation, but he was actually the first who looked at the ancient Hebrew Bible and saw its internal inconsistencies. Back to my teacher saying, you know, what a stupid boy this was to think that the Torah wasn't divinely inspired, that Moses didn't write it down. I mean, of course, one of the things that Spinoza pointed out is that there are chapters of the Torah that are written after Moses died. But of course, that caused us no difficulty. It certainly caused my teacher no difficulty because he had prophecy, so he was able to prophesize after his death. So you know that there was no difficulty there that couldn't be reconciled. But I remember hearing about this bad boy, and I asked my teacher, "Well, what did he mean that nature is God?" And she looked at me very suspiciously. It was probably the first time I had ever asked a question in class. I think she was surprised to see me there at all. And this is the first time I'm showing any interest. And she said, well, you know, she didn't answer me very well. And I sort of was pressing her, and does he mean by nature flowers and trees? Does he mean laws of nature? What does he mean? And she didn't like where these questions were going at all. And I got put in my place. But I was intrigued, and I remember I got out Bertrand Russell's A History of Western Philosophy and started to read about these philosophers, and started to read specifically about Spinoza. And so he is, in fact, somebody who has had a huge influence on my life, and that's not so very important. What's important is that he had a huge influence on many people's lives, on many individuals' lives, that Spinoza really did radicalize Europe. And even while people were denouncing him, and actually to become a professor or a clergy in Europe, the 100 years following Spinoza's death, you had to have your denunciations of Spinoza ready. That was part of the oral exam, that you had to know where Spinoza made his mistakes. Which meant that everybody was reading him. They had to read him in order to denounce him. So he was radicalizing Europe, and in about 100 years, they were ready for the Enlightenment. The other thing that I was, which is still ongoing and our work is not done quite clearly, the other thing about Spinoza that Bart's talk reminded me of is that I couldn't agree with you more that as humanists, as those in the confraternity of the fatherless, the order of those who cannot believe, it can't be just negative. It can't be the rejection of belief, but something very positive. And the reason that Spinoza was so dangerous to the spirit of religion, the reason that he was denounced over and over again, and that well into the Age of Enlightenment, Kant had to defend himself against charges of being a closet Spinozist. The reason he was seen as so dangerous is because he's so positive. His magnum opus is called The Ethics. And in it, he argues that there is no room in a vision, an enlightened vision of the world, for the notion of a transcendent God. So he certainly argues against any notion of transcendent God. But the most important thing he does, and it's what gives the title to his magnum opus, is that he demonstrates that you don't need God in order to ground morality. He derives morality from human nature itself. And it's a grand and an inspiring vision of the largest kind of life that we can live, a life always thinking in terms of the eternity, so what he calls sub specie, living life sub specie eternitatis, under the guise of a form of eternity, an inspiring and a transcendent notion of living life, which is completely secular, which is transcendent because it's secular. And this is, I think, something that we still have to learn from Spinoza, that there is such a positive vision, a positive message that can be gotten out of a secular point of view, and that quite the contrary, that one as one often hears, that we need God in order to be good, or in order to ground morality, or in any case, in order to enforce morality. What reason would one have for being good if there isn't the great police officer upstairs giving, you know, ready to give you a summons? Spinoza demonstrates this grand and high-minded and noble and transcendent view of how we can live our lives on purely secular grounds. And that's why he was so despised, why he was so feared, why he had to be condemned, why he was called Satan's emissary on earth, why his theological, political treatise was described over and over again as a book forged in hell. Other people said things as radical, but, as for example, David Hume, you know, in his arguments against miracles or against arguments for the existence of God. But what Spinoza does is to inspire with a secular vision. So over and over again, it was not just a little girl like me, an ignorant little girl in a right-wing yeshiva who fell in love with Spinoza, but this happened over and over again, that people fell in love with Spinoza and with his vision of the world, this very positive vision of the world, and with this extraordinary ideal that to the extent to which we're rational, that we all share exactly the same identity, that the differences between us matter not at all. So there is, as Wilde had dreamed in his jail cell, a kind of confraternity of the fatherless. And just one more little gloss on that beautiful phrase of Oscar Wilde, the confraternity of the fatherless. There is, as I said, a kind of ethics in hardcore rational epistemology in demanding good grounds for one's beliefs, in holding all of one's beliefs to high standards. There's also, I think, a kind of ethical vision that comes out of the recognition that we are fatherless. And it is the kind of ethical obligation, that ethical responsibility that comes from recognizing or from rejecting the false consolations of false beliefs, of ways of trying to reconcile ourselves to the terrible suffering in this world, and of course in philosophy and theological philosophy, there's an entire branch of philosophy to trying to reconcile the goodness and the omnipotence of God with the terrible suffering in this world. It's known as theodicy. In recognizing the confraternity of the fatherless, we reject that there can be any such consolations, and that we realize that there is no ultimate supernatural force that's going to right these wrongs, that the only way that these wrongs are going to be righted is for us to do it, that it's our responsibility. And so that there is, a kind of ethics that grows out of accepting responsibility for the world's ills. We are it. All that others have are others. We have to do it for one another. We're all in on this together. It is the confraternity of the fatherless, and it places tremendous responsibilities on us. It demands that we be grown-ups. We are fatherless. We must accept this responsibility and be full grown-ups. To me, that is what this organization is all about. It is the very meaning of being a humanist. It is the vision that people like Spinoza and Wilde dreamed of, and now it's ours to make the most of. Thank you.
Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here, Humanist of the Year, 2010. And I'm doing now exactly what you're doing. I'm listening to the Humanist Hour. Just turn it up loud.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Todd Stiefel. Welcome back.
Listeners, you can learn more about Rebecca Goldstein. You can purchase her book, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a Work of Fiction. And much more from her website, which is RebeccaGoldstein.com. You'll also find a link to RebeccaGoldstein.com from the show notes for this page, which you might notice look a little different, Todd. We forgot to mention in our news section in the beginning of the show that we have a brand new website.
Indeed, we have a great new website, which is part of the new Humanist Magazine website that you can find, which has all sorts of great things. It's got information about us. It's got ways to subscribe to the show with links to iTunes or RSS. It also has archives of the show where you can listen to shows that were recorded in the past. And what else does it have, Jess?
Well, first, let's say go to thehumanisthour.org. As Todd said, you'll mention that we are under the umbrella of the Humanist website. We've been sort of gearing you up for that for months. You can listen to and read about any of our previous episodes. You can also now comment on our shows. So one of the many ways for you to get in touch with us, Todd mentioned there's a contact page. You can call our listener comment line, 202-618-1371. And also, as you're looking at each show notes page, so each episode, all you got to do is click on the link of the title. You can read the content, which will have information about all of our segments, all of our guests, all their links. You can listen to that episode, and at the very bottom, you can now comment. So I'm very excited for that. The last thing that I'll say is that while you're looking around on the humanist.org, which you'll notice looks different as well, you can pop out our podcast player. So there's a podcast player on the right-hand sidebar of our podcast page, and there's a podcast player at the very bottom of the homepage of thehumanist.org. And at the bottom, you'll see pop out to listen and browse. So if you allow that pop-up window to open, you can then browse the website while listening to any of our past episodes. So I hope you folks enjoy it, and certainly let us know what you think.
Awesome. Well, we have another guest today who we alluded to earlier in the show, Richard Dawkins.
That's right, Todd. So Richard Dawkins was sort of a special guest at our 70th annual conference this past April. He spoke to the audience at large, our conference attendees. And afterwards, he was kind enough to do an interview with you, Todd, and our coworker, Jennifer Barty, who is the editor of the Humanist magazine.
Well, first of all, welcome, Richard, to the Humanist Hour podcast once again. First thing I'd like to talk to you about today is the Richard Dawkins Foundation, which I think is unique in our movement in that it tends to be an organization that exists oftentimes for the benefit of the movement as a whole, but also for the individual other organizations in the movement, in that the foundation is a supporter of many organizations, including the American Humanist Association. And so I was just curious, what's happening at the Richard Dawkins Foundation and what's next?
Well, it's true that we do collect money, not just for our own running costs, but also for donation to other organizations in our movement. And I think that's a very important thing to do insofar as we may have certain strengths in raising money from certain sources, which maybe other organizations have strengths in raising money from different sources. We are interested in education, science, reason, not so much in campaigning about whether the dollar bill has In God We Trust or something of that sort, not so much in separation of church and state or other sort of peculiarly American issues like that. Science and reason, education, promoting science as the alternative to a supernatural view of the world. Because science is so exciting, so fascinating, and should simply wipe out any supernaturalist competitors off the map.
Professor Dawkins, yesterday you spoke to us about this idea of metaphor and kind of, I think you called it sinister symbolism. But first you gave us some examples of the use of metaphor and analogy in explaining scientific concepts. elucidating some truths. And I think that's sort of the best use of that kind of literary form. And then the flip side of that was with religion, that typically the metaphor becomes the truth, that there's actually no concept behind it, backing it up.
I would be hypocritical if I just knocked metaphor generally, because I'm within the field of science writing. I'm known to be a user of metaphor a lot. I use a lot of metaphors, and I gave examples, some of my own, some of other people's, which are really, really helpful because they do useful work in actually helping the explanation along. You actually do get the explanation better if you listen to the metaphor. And sometimes the scientist even gets the right answer through using a metaphor, which he wouldn't have got without it. So that's the positive side. When theologians start using metaphors, however, and symbols, personification, they forget that it is a metaphor, or at least if they don't forget, their congregation certainly do, and they don't go out of their way. People like bishops and archbishops and sophisticated theologians don't go out of their way to warn their congregation, look, this is only a metaphor. Mm-hmm. And I gave examples of archbishops, two archbishops and a pope, all talking about Adam and Eve as if Adam and Eve ever existed. They, of course, know perfectly well Adam and Eve never existed, and they're using Adam and Eve in a kind of poetic sense. But it's rather bad poetry because it doesn't actually help the explanation along at all. And it's very, very bad in that it gives the congregation, the audience, the misleading impression that the archbishop or the pope actually believes in Adam and Eve. And sometimes these sophisticated so-called theologians protest that, oh, nobody believes that anymore. Well, they damn well do believe that anymore, as polls show.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. How did you put it, Todd?
One of the key differences is they take their metaphors literally.
Yes.
We don't.
At least the congregations do.
Absolutely.
And the archbishops may not. But even they, I sometimes think, get so intoxicated with metaphor that it's almost as though they don't care whether it's true or not. It's a sort of secondary, unimportant detail whether it's true. Oh, we don't care whether it's true or not. I mean, it's just, but it really does matter when you're a scientist and especially if you're a science educator.
Well, it does go back to the power of storytelling, but I think it was also raised that, you know, perhaps there are theologians who are themselves, they doubt the story, they doubt the entire concept, but that they're so mired in the symbolism as a way to somehow protect their intellectual integrity.
Yes.
Interestingly, though, this afternoon at the conference, Candace Gingrich Jones mentioned that her kind of awakening to reason was in a Sunday school class when there was a metaphor used about the willow tree, and I think it had something to do with the thorns on Christ's head and becoming the willow tree, and that's why the willow tree weeps. And she said she had an epiphany at that moment that this didn't make any sense.
Of course. I mean, that's the negative side of it.
I had the privilege, Richard, of reading one of the early versions of your upcoming book, The Magic of Reality. And I was wondering if you could share with our listeners a little bit about when that's coming out, what it's about.
Okay. The Magic of Reality is a book for, I'm not allowed to say children, I have to say young people, publisher's orders. It is about science, and that each chapter is sort of semi-isolated from the others. They don't have to be read in order. So the chapters like what is the sun, what is an earthquake, what is a rainbow, and each chapter begins with three or four myths, for example, about the sun, or myths, for example, about earthquakes, and then goes on to the science of what is the sun, what really is the sun, and the first chapter is about magic itself. What do we mean by magic? And I distinguish three different kinds of magic. There's supernatural magic, as in pumpkins turning into coaches. There's conjuring magic, as when a conjurer pulls a rabbit out of a hat. And there's magic, as in when Carl Sagan looks up at the stars and invokes the magic of the universe. And so, obviously, the magic of reality is the last kind. And I'm trying to destroy all idea of supernatural magic.
That's great. I mean, it sort of ties in with this idea of trying to retain that storytelling that leads to a greater truth.
Yes, but you don't need supernaturalism. Reality is magically wonderful in its own right.
Sounds great.
Thanks.
So, Jess, pretty interesting that Richard has a new book coming out. I'm really looking forward to seeing the final version of that and reading parts of it to my kids, see what they think about it. I think they're probably a little young for his current target audience, but I think they'll be able to pick up on and understand pieces of it, especially given the fact that it'll have illustrations in it and the like. I think it might be a very useful tool for helping them understand the basics of science.
Yeah, definitely. I think it really speaks to his talent as a writer to be able to make, you know, science accessible to so many different kinds of people, which is something that I think, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson shares that talent, and obviously Bill Nye the Science Guy, just being able to communicate these scientific lessons and scientific ideas and facts and hypotheses with kids. I think it's both important and pretty cool.
It is really cool. I'm also interested to learn more about some of the mythology, because each section on science starts with the mythological explanation for these scientific phenomenon, or, you know, different pieces of that. He uses examples from various myths and religions from around the world. So it'll be interesting to hear some of the creative stories our ancestors had to explain things they just didn't understand.
Absolutely. And I have to admit, I'm also excited to see what I learn from the book.
As I mentioned, I was fortunate enough to be able to read an early edition of it, and I learned a lot. There was definitely all sorts of things in there that I didn't know. And there were certain things that have, you know, the scientific body has learned since I was in school. And so I got a good update and learned some of the more modern stuff. It was fascinating.
Well, I certainly think it fills a need, which is a way for parents to communicate with their children about the things that we do understand about how the world works and how the universe works, and that it is quite amazing.
Absolutely.
So I'm grateful, and I'm also excited for that book. So where can folks go to find out more?
You can find out more about Richard and his foundation, the Richard Dawkins Foundation for Reason and Science, which is one of the great supporters of the movement. They don't try to compete with any of the organizations. They actually give a lot of donations to various organizations in the movement, such as the American Humanist Association. And you could find out about both his foundation and Richard himself at richarddawkins.net. And that book, by the way, I believe it comes out in the fall, The Magic of Reality.
Well, Todd, I think that about wraps up our show for this month.
Yeah, it was fun. Great again. And looking forward to next month, where we'll be rolling some more clips from the AHA convention. Get to do a wrap-up of what happened with the Day of Reason, and also get to talk about the Rapture Day, which also is coming up soon, the May 21st.
Wait a second. The Rapture Day? I thought the world was supposed to end in 2012.
Well, that's the Mayan version, but they're clearly off base. We are talking about the fundamentalist evangelical Christians have calculated that, according to the Bible, the world is going to end on May 21st at some specific time that day. There are billboards all over the place in North Carolina pronouncing that it's time to repent. The rapture is at hand. There is some woman who has painted her car and has been with messages about this, and she's been in the newspaper. And oh boy, this is a big deal. They are convinced that the apocalypse is upon us and that it is time to be saved. And it's an interesting time for them, I'm sure. Very interestingly, they, while believing the world is about to end, certainly aren't acting like it. They aren't blowing all their money or, you know, I'm a little unclear because I know there's a specific time that this is supposed to occur, at which point, you know, they get to go off into heaven and we're all done for. But mm-hmm. we're a little unclear as to which time zone that this is going to be happening in. So will the world be destroyed promptly at the end of the 21st or whatever the time is, Eastern Standard Time, or maybe it's Jerusalem time? We're a right. little unsure. So watch out, because we might get taken out sometime during the day on May 20th potentially, yep. because it'll be the 21st further over east. So
I see.
You know, we all need to be wary for a couple days there.
All right, well, seriously, Todd, down the pipeline, we've got some pretty exciting things happening. May, obviously, like you said, we'll wrap up what happened on May 5th, which is the National Day of Reason. And also, we'll be playing an interview with Candace Gingrich-Jones and her acceptance speech of our first ever LGBT Humanist Pride Award. So that's very exciting. And of course, we're playing that in May to gear up for June, which is Pride Month, where lots of LGBT Pride events will be happening all over the country. So
awesome.
We've got some of our other recipients for you, namely Steve Wozniak, Bert Ehrman, Judy Norsegian, and also we're going to play some of the breakout sessions, as well as the closing talk by Jeff Charlotte, our keynote speaker. So lots of good stuff. We also, Todd, are planning a sex episode or a sex episode.
Awesome. Looking forward to that.
So listeners, definitely stay in touch. TheHumanistHour.org. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Todd Stiefel.
Thanks for listening to The Humanist Hour.
Thanks for listening.